Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Limitations on Insider Trading Claims Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 26, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Credit Suisse Securities v. Simmons. The question in this case was whether, under the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934, the two-year time limit on filing lawsuits to force a corporate insider to disgorge short-swing profits only begins to run when the insider files the disclosure statement required by the Act. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit had ruled that the limitations period was tolled and therefore did not begin to run until the disclosure statement was filed. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia and joined by all other justices except the Chief Justice, who took no part in the consideration or the decision of the case, the court held that, even assuming the two-year limitations period could be extended, the Ninth Circuit erred in determining it was tolled until the disclosure statement was filed. The court further indicated that it was divided 4-4, on whether the Ninth Circuit erred in rejecting the claim below that the two-year time limit created a period of repose not subject to equitable tolling. As a result, the court affirmed that determination without precedential effect, but otherwise vacated the Ninth Circuit ruling and remanded the case for further proceedings. To discuss the case, we have Deanne Maynard and Jordan F., who are partners at Morrison & Foster, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, Jordan F.
This is Jordan, and we're talking about the Credit Suisse case. And the case arises actually in a very obscure area of securities litigation, Section 16B litigation. I've been doing this kind of work for about 25 years, and I don't know that I've ever seen Section 16B litigation, let alone one up at the Supreme Court level, because it really is a pretty obscure area. What Section 16B does is it prohibits short swing trading by officers, directors, or 10% holders of public companies. In other words, an officer, director, or 10% holder can't buy and sell or sell and buy within a six-month period. It's a pretty blunt instrument designed to prevent insider trading. A company can sue its own officers or directors or 10% holders for violations of 16B. And a whole cottage industry has developed of plaintiff's lawyers who monitor filings and try to make sure that companies are pursuing claims that they may have. The statute, as I said, I think, is that it's a strict liability statute, and it's the statute that requires the Form 4s that we all see reported in newspapers and otherwise. What's most important here is that the statute has a provision that says no such suit shall be brought more than 2 years after the date such profit, in other words, the short swing profit, was realized. What the plaintiffs did in this case, and it's really quite odd, is they sued dozens of investment banks. Investment banks had been underwriters of IPOs at the end of the 90s. So this all happened a long time ago. And the claim is that those banks, those investment banks, at one time or another, owned more than 10% of the securities of these companies that are just going public, that therefore they were required to file Form 4s under Section 16, and because they had been involved in an underwriting, had violated the substantive terms of Section 16. The investment banks, of course, never filed those forms, so they were never subject to the rule, that the rule just didn't apply in that circumstance. The district court, when confronted with a complaint and a motion to dismissed the claim, said that they were time-barred, said that plaintiffs had known all the facts necessary to file a claim at least for 5 years. Remember, the statute talks about 2 years after profit, at least 5 years before filing. On appeal, though, the Ninth Circuit reversed based on a case called Whitaker versus Whitaker, a Ninth Circuit case that said that the statute of limitations under Section 16 doesn't begin to run until the filing of the Section 16A disclosure, which makes it kind of difficult because the underwriters were taking the position that they never had to file it. So that's the basis of the case before it got to the Supreme Court level. Let me kick it over to Deanne to talk about what happened at the Supreme Court.
Thanks, Jordan. The banks sought review of essentially two questions. First, whether the two-year limitations period was a statute of repose. In other words, is it a limitation that can never be told, but runs out no matter what, 2 years after the short swing profit is realized? Second, they also sought review of, even if it can be told, Does tolling continue even after receipt of notice of facts giving rise to the action? The Supreme Court, in the end, did not decide the first question. The Chief Justice was recused, and the eight justices who did hear the case divided 4-4 on whether the limitations period was one of repose. The court thus affirmed, without any precedential effect, the portion of the Ninth Circuit's decision that it held that the limitations period could be told. Nevertheless, the justices vacated the decision. The eight justices agreed unanimously in rejecting the Ninth Circuit's Whitaker rule. The court held that the Whitaker rule could not be squared with the text of the statute, which, as Jordan noted, provides 2 years from the date the short swing profit is realized. The court reasons that Congress could have very easily provided that no such suit shall be brought more than 2 years after the filing of a statement under Section 16A, but Congress did not do that. Justice Scalia, who wrote for the court, explained that even though the Whitaker rule was labeled as one of equitable tolling, the rule was, quote, completely divorced from long-settled equitable tolling principles, unquote. For instance, the rule would allow plaintiffs to sue long after they've become aware of facts underlying their claim. Indeed, the court noted the particular inequity here of applying the Whitaker rule. As Jordan mentioned, the banks disclaimed any requirement that they file a Rule 16A statement at all. Yet, as the plaintiff acknowledged, under her theory, as long as they never filed a Rule 16A statement, she could buy stocks in companies who had IPOs even 20 years ago and still bring claims for short swing transactions. The court rejected that potential for such endless tolling, where a reasonably diligent plaintiff would know the facts underlying her claim. Such tolling would be, in the words of the court, out of step with the purpose of limitations periods in general, and it would be especially at odds with a provision like the one here that imposes strict liability. The court concluded that if Congress had intended this result, it most certainly would have said so. For similar reasons, the court, in a footnote, also rejected the somewhat different rule that the Second Circuit had developed. That court had held that Section 16B claims were told until a plaintiff had actual notice that a person subject to Section 16A had realized specific short swing profits that were worth pursuing. In the end, the Supreme Court remanded for the lower courts to apply the ordinary equitable tolling principles to the facts of this case, so they didn't decide how this case would come out on the merits. And how is this decision interesting from a Supreme Court practitioner's perspective? To me, the 4-4 divide is especially interesting. If the chief had not been recused, the court may well have held by a vote of 5-4 that the 2-year period was one of repose and could never be extended. And that, of course, would put to rest any litigation. The court had said as much in dicta in its earlier decision in Lamp. So I think it will be interesting to see if the court looks for another case in which to revisit this question, a case in which it would be at full strength, or whether these cases will resolve themselves in the lower courts in a way that the Supreme Court will not feel the need to weigh in again. Jordan, what do you see as implications from a securities law perspective?
Well, Deanne, I don't think it's that much, actually, in the Section 16B area. As I mentioned at the outset, there aren't that many Section 16B cases. And on top of that, this case arises in a very odd setting, involving claims that underwriters of offerings should have been subject to or were subject to Section 16. So I don't think it's going to be in that context where it's interesting. I think where it is interesting, though, is it highlights a real split in the court on how to interpret private rights of action. So Deanne mentioned that 4 members of the court would have applied what I'll call regular old equitable tolling rules. 4 others read the statute much more strictly and some would argue more faithfully. And they found that the statute of limitations here is really a statute of repose that cannot, under any circumstances, be told. We've seen similar positions taken in other securities cases in the last few years. For example, the Morrison case involving extraterritorial liability under Rule 10B, or the Janus case involving who makes a statement under 10B. And there we've seen these kinds of splits, with some of the justices taking a very strict view, saying that if it isn't right there in black and white, then there is no claim, and others saying that more ordinary rules applied in other contexts should apply. So I think it's consistent with that same split we've been seeing, where in general the stricter reading has been winning out, although not by much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.